Welcome to St. Louis on the Air. I'm Don Marsh. There are significant disparities between the African-American community in St. Louis and other groups. A comprehensive five-part study is underway to find out why and what can be done about it. The study is funded by the Missouri Foundation for Health. Partners in that study include Washington and St. Louis Universities, the St. Louis American, the Institute for Public Health, and the St. Louis Beacon. The project is called For the Sake of All, a report on the health and well-being of African Americans in St. Louis. The first of the five parts is out. And joining me in studio to talk about the initial findings and overall objective of the study are Dr. Jason Purnell of the Brown School at Washington University. He is the lead researcher. Dr. William Tate of Washington University and Dr. Keon Gilbert of St. Louis University are part of the study team. Dr. Gilbert's also heading a separate study on health issues relating to African-American men. Gentlemen, thanks so much for being with us. Nice to have you here.
Thank you
for having us.
Jason Purnell, I'm going to start with you and just ask you what the overall objective of this is.
The overall objective is really to broaden the conversation around health disparities to include what we call the social determinants of health and public health. And that's really just all of the factors outside of medical care that we know impact health outcomes and health disparities, factors like education and economic status, which is what we're focusing on.
And I suppose just the opposite is true, that the health situation of people involved would affect the other part of their lives.
Oh, definitely, definitely. Yeah. And it's a complex set of pathways and mechanisms that we study, but we know that these factors like education and economic status do have an impact on health outcomes, sometimes a larger impact than even health insurance or medical care.
Bill Tate, can I ask you to give me some indication of what you found in your first findings?
Well, that particular paper is focused on the relationship between public health and school dropout. And we asked the question, is there a relationship between kids dropping out of school and their health? And there is. There are three big pathways that happen. The first is when children have lots of physical illness. It means they miss days in school, and that leads to school dropout. There's also concern about mental health issues and our ability to provide them student support who have mental health challenges. That also leads to school dropout. And then there are early school problems that happen that really are related to behavioral problems that ultimately can lead to school dropout. And these pathways are very important because in the St. Louis public schools, for example, in 1 year, about 3,000 kids in 9-12 dropped out of school. And we want to understand why that's happening. And it's clear from the research that these three pathways are influential, and they're actually public health questions that impact what happens in school outcomes. And so we would like to provide some insight or solutions perhaps to support those three pathways and kids' opportunities to develop both healthy lives and productive educational outcomes.
Mm. Hey, Keon Gilbert, why health? Why connect the dots from health to all of these other aspects?
Well, for a number of reasons. I think when we think about a broad definition of health or health and well-being, it's really important to think about the context in which health kind of takes place. So thinking about where we live, where we work, where we play, and how those environments shape our health or influence our health decisions. So it's really important in thinking about those, not only those contexts, but also thinking about how people end up working in some cases where they work or where they live. So those are determined by a number of kind of larger macro factors. So it's really important in thinking about how those all kind of work together and how they in many ways intersect to affect people's health decisions. So, for example, if you live in a particular neighborhood, some neighborhoods may not have access to full service grocery stores. And so certainly that will have some impact on the decisions that you make in terms of eating, and certainly also thinking about crime as another example that may influence people's decisions to exercise out in their neighborhoods or not. And so all of these larger issues really have an impact on our day-to-day decisions on our health.
One of the things that hasn't been mentioned yet, and Jason, I'll turn it back to you here, would be the issue of poverty playing a key role in all of the things that have been mentioned so far. It seems to me that that's the bedrock for what we're talking about here today.
Definitely. It's part of what we're talking about. And in terms of the first brief, Bill just gave you sort of a preview of the second brief. The first brief, what we found was that we were able to estimate that 280 deaths of the more than 3,000 deaths among African Americans in 2011 were attributable to poverty. Another 237 were attributable to low levels of education. So poverty is definitely playing a leading role in this. And we know that there are disparities in poverty in St. Louis City and St. Louis County, where African Americans have a poverty rate of around 29%, compared to whites having a rate of about 8%.
I'm not quite sure what the connection is between mortality and education.
There's several, as I said, it's complex, but there are several pathways that we believe are driving this association between low levels of education and health outcomes like mortality. For instance, people who have lower levels of education go on to have lower levels of economic status in terms of income. They're less able to buy things like health insurance, but also less likely to buy homes that are safe and have healthy environments, less likely to live in safe neighborhoods, less likely to have access to social networks where they get information and resources, less likely to engage in health behaviors that we know promote health. So education is linked in all of those ways to mortality.
So, Bill Tate, that brings us right back to the whole environmental issue that Keon was talking about a moment ago.
Indeed. And one of the things that is a follow-up to Jason's brief is that we see in St. Louis there are supports, for example, for physical illness. We have a wonderful infrastructure that the public health community has put together. However, it's extremely fragile in the sense that the supports, financial supports for that, ebb and flow. And in that case, kids who might have physical illnesses, they're poor. They don't have access then to appropriate services to help them. They're going to miss school. They miss school. They drop out. Once they drop out, it falls right into the trap that Jason just alluded to. You drop out of school. You don't have access to insurance. You don't live in places that are probably going to provide you the right social networks to help you have a more healthy life. And it's a vicious cycle once this happens.
Keon, you know, when you hear things like this and some of the numbers that we've already heard, it makes you wonder, doesn't it, that is this really the 21st century in the United States of America? Are we talking about a third world kind of situation?
Absolutely. In many cases, some of the situations, some of the health problems and social determinants that Jason mentioned earlier, in many ways reflect third world countries. And one of the issues, especially here in St. Louis, is that St. Louis is highly segregated. And when you have high rates of segregation, you have these clusters or these concentrations of poverty, of low education attainment, as well as of chronic diseases. And that's in many ways some of the issues that we're looking at through this collaborative effort is how in many ways our health problems as well as kind of larger issues like education, low educational attainment, clustered in certain areas in the metropolitan area. So it's really important for us to focus on how these things kind of start clustering together.
I wonder why this is something of an aside, but I'd be interested in your take on this. I wonder why St. Louis is the way that it is. I mean, it has not a terrific reputation nationally for race relations, and racial polarization is obviously something that's very much a part of this society.
Absolutely. I'm not from St. Louis, so I can't speak to the long history of segregation, patterns of segregation here in St. Louis. I only know a little bit from what I've learned after being here.
But you know that it exists.
Oh, absolutely. It's very prominent. You know, when you drive up and down the highways and you see the different municipalities, it's very clear that there are boundaries that are drawn very heavily here, as well as social boundaries. And one of the things that's been mentioned here in terms of social networks, the inability for people to kind of penetrate or to open up their social networks has severe impact on people's ability to get helpful information, whether that's helpful information related to getting better jobs, helpful information in terms of accessing certain kinds of educational resources or educational supports, as well as being able to access things even like transportation. And so we even know that our transportation system is somewhat limited in a number of ways.
And the professional area networking is limited.
Yes, yeah. Absolutely.
But Bill, I think I was just going to jump in on that question. There is a well-documented economic history about why we have the current situation.
Are you a native St. Louisan, by the way?
I am not. I am from Chicago,
all right,
which is another very highly segregated place. It has a well-documented history,
sure,
as well. And you look at redlining that took place here. You look at restricted covenants. You look at the federal subsidies that took place in the 1950s and 60s related to the expansion of the suburban areas that were very limited in who could have access to them. And what we have now is a product of all of these factors coming together, because we don't have great – it's not a dynamic system that we're dealing with here in terms of people's movement. It's pretty static, and these were huge and powerful political tools and economic tools that were used to create our current context, and we live with that today. We live with that in our education system. We live with that in our public health system. And we live with that in the fact that these two systems are integrated and related to one another, and the effects are continuous right now. I mean, we live with that.
You know, it's interesting that St. Louis has a tendency to pat itself on the back because Shelley versus Kramer, which the Supreme Court decided and did away with restrictive covenants, came out of a case in St. Louis. What is often forgotten is the fact that there was a need for such a case here in St. Louis. Jason, how about you? Your take on this? Are you a native St. Louis?
I am a native St. Louis.
Oh, okay. Well, let's
and in answer to the famous question, St. Louis, you high. I think that what happens very often is that we create these boundaries and we don't think imaginatively enough about what's possible as a region and thinking as a region, not as 91 municipalities or whatever we have in St. Louis County versus the city, North City versus South City. We react to caricatures of each other rather than actual people. I was just at a fundraiser last night. I'm on the board of Loyola Academy, which is right up the street here on Washington. And the room was filled with people who aren't from around this area, I would venture to guess, but who care very deeply about the work that we're doing with the boys there. So I think there's an opportunity to capitalize on the very humanitarian spirit here in St. Louis. We've got you wouldn't expect the kind of fundraising that we do, for example, for our United Way campaign every year, given the size and scope of our metropolitan area. But we do have generosity in this community. And part of what we're trying to do is reframe this debate so that people begin to see investment in resources and not people as problems, not reacting to people as caricatures.
Well, we have to take a break now. We'll end this first segment on that note. My guests in studios are Dr. Jason Purnell, from whom you just heard. He is the guy behind the study that we're talking about, For the Sake of All study, the first part of which has already been released. Also with me in studios, Dr. William Tate of Washington University, as is Dr. Purnell, and Dr. Keon Gilbert of St. Louis University. They are members of the team which participated in this study. We'll come back and continue our conversation in just a moment. If you'd like to be a part of it, you are certainly welcome. Give us a call at 382-8255. That's 382-TALK. You can send us an email at talk@stlpublicradio.org. And, of course, we'll take a tweet at STL on Air. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. And welcome back. We are talking about a study that is underway that is going to be lasting for the next several months. It will culminate. And Jason, why don't you tell us what's going to happen? This is a 5-part study, and you've got a target date for all 5 being finished next year. And there's a specific reason for that.
Well, actually, the 5 briefs will all come out this year. What we're targeting for next year is actually a larger full report. And that will come out in May of 2014. And 2014 is significant for 2 reasons. It's the 60th anniversary of Brown versus the Board of Education, the landmark Supreme Court case that struck down desegregation and education, segregation in education, rather, and also the 50th anniversary of the Civil Rights Act of 1964.
So you're tying that in somehow with your final report. Okay. the five briefs are done this year and you have this big session next year. What then? You got a conversation started. How do you make that conversation turn into something tangible in terms of results?
I think what we're really trying to do is influence the policy agenda here in our region and bring both scientific evidence to bear, but also community engagement to bear on what should be this agenda. What should we do to move forward? And bringing people to the table who aren't typically at the table when we talk about health and health disparities. So we have a community partner group that includes people in economic development, people in education, including also the public health departments and people in healthcare. So really broadening the conversation and hopefully having some sort of permanent coalition of individuals and people across sectors in this region who are willing to move this agenda forward.
Bill Tate, the issue of public policy, that's something I gather from things you said off the air are of special interest to you.
Indeed. I think Jason lays it out very well, but I think one of the things we would like to see happen is civic engagement and civic problem solving. And in order to do that, you need good data, you need to understand the mechanisms, and you need to bring people together to coalesce around the evidence that exists. And so we're researchers in the end, and our job is to bring the evidence to bear and to the extent we can scream as loud as possible to say we need to work together in terms of civic problem solving around these areas. And that's what we can do. That's our dream. I mean, that's the way I look at it. I've been here 11 years, and I like to say when it's over that some group of researchers actually came together, building off the research that's already existed on the region and tried to make a difference.
Keon Gilbert, how optimistic, though, can you be about these objectives, given what we were just talking about concerning the way this society here is structured?
I think that we all are very optimistic about the possibilities of this project. And I think part of it is making sure that we, one, recognize that, you know, this is a really collaborative effort. And part of that collaboration includes not only our partnership group, but also recognizing that there have been a number of initiatives that have happened before us. And so we realize that we're not the first to ever try to do this, and we will not be the last. But we're hoping that as a group of interested people in the issues and solutions around health disparities in St. Louis, that we can use the data, use the evidence in a way that helps to really in many ways not only provide additional awareness, but maybe provide some tools and resources for people to use to kind of go back to their respective communities and say, you know, we knew this was going on in our communities. Here is some evidence to support what we thought was going on. These may be opportunities for people to kind of start organizing in a different way, maybe than they have before, and as well as maybe building some new partnerships and new bridges that did not exist before.
What kind of tools are we talking about? What kind of tools are available or could be made available, do you think? Anyone? Jason?
The primary tool that we're interested in are a set of policy recommendations, also programmatic recommendations, and that builds on very significantly on what's already happening in St. Louis. One of the reasons to be optimistic is because things are already happening. Sometimes they may need to be brought to scale. They may need to be made more universal. But even in our first brief, we highlight the great work that's being done around early childhood at the Southside Early Childhood Center. We talk about the Promise Accounts program through Beyond Housing and their 24-1 initiative in the Normandy School District, where every kindergartner in the Normandy School District who enters gets a $500 savings account. And that's not just government coming in and implementing programs and policies. That program in Normandy School District is a private donor who's decided to give money towards making sure that children have those educational opportunities. And we know that those educational opportunities have these ripple effects.
Yeah. I think another big kind of resource or asset is to even make ourselves available to the community in terms of we all have come together for this particular initiative, but we all have our own individual areas of interest and areas of expertise. And I think even knowing that we kind of exist in St. Louis across these two institutions is a really important thing for people to know and to be aware of. I think in many ways we would like for this opportunity to invite others in and to be invited to other places and other spaces in St. Louis that are interested in either very specific health issues or even broader health issues.
Bill Tate, did you want to add something there?
I was just going to add on that civic progress basically takes place when there's collective cognition. If people come together and they see evidence and they see pathways and triggers that lead to certain outcomes that they don't think are the kind of outcomes they want, that's a tool and that's a resource and that's a big deal. And, for example, we know that we do a great job with childhood physical illness here. But if you were to ask people about psychological services for youth, if the people in the know will say it's underdeveloped, how many people in our community really know that? That youth who have a need for services of that sort really are probably not going to get it. And I think that's a big deal. That's collective cognition, bringing a habit of mind about thinking about data with people in our community so that we can really make a difference and just identify the problems. And in these two ways, it's important. I think one way we're supporting the great work that's already being done. And we want to highlight what many of our colleagues who are in the trenches doing say to us. They're telling us about psychological services. They're saying, we don't have the infrastructure. We don't have the financial resources to do it. We know it's a problem. We know it's leading to kids dropping out. We know it's leading to all kind of criminal behavior. We know it's leading to all kind of health outcomes that are negative. But we don't have any infrastructure. We have no financial support. Well, our job as researchers and university faculty is to make sure that everybody understands that that's a reality.
Yeah, Jason, it seems to me that we've known a lot of these things for a long time, that a study isn't necessary to tell us some of the things that we have known with regard to resources that are available and programs that are available or not available.
I think we have known some of these things before, but as we say in the first brief, not all the connections are always clear to people. So we know, for instance, that we have significant challenges in terms of education and educational equity in this region. But does everyone know that those inequities also lead to health disparities down the line? Do they know what kind of economic impact someone else's child not completing high school has on them? That's also part of the story that we're trying to tell. And Keon actually gave us the great title for this project, For the Sake of All, which is actually an unfinished Scott Joplin composition, mm-hmm. which we think is perfect because we have unfinished business here in St. Louis as well. But part of that story we're trying to tell is how this impacts not just African Americans, but the entire region.
And the impact, the financial impact, is considerable. I saw some of the numbers related to the work that you've been doing.
Yes.
And it's mind-blowing.
Yes. $3.3 billion is what we estimate in terms of that loss of life that I talked about earlier. The 280 deaths due to poverty, 237 due to low levels of education.
Now, how does that add up to more than $3 billion?
The health economists helped us out on that estimate, but it's really an estimate based on what people are willing to pay in terms of a reduction of risk in mortality. So what people are willing to pay for even small reductions in risk.
Okay, I want to go to the phones if you're ready for that, unless someone has something to add. Ready to go? Let's bring in Debbie, calling from St. Louis. Debbie, thanks for waiting. Go ahead. Debbie, Hello. Are you there?
Hello?
Yeah, go ahead, please.
Oh, hi. I live in South St. Louis City, the poorest part of South St. Louis City. And I live among the people, I suppose, that there's the experts are speaking about most of the, the neighborhood is mostly African-American, low-income, obviously. And I've lived here my whole life. My family was always poor. So even though we're white, we face the same problems as the people around here. And a lot of the problems are the same as they were, 40 years ago, and it's healthcare services, and especially mental healthcare services, are not nearly as available, or even few people know if any of these services even exist a lot of times. they tend to, when I listen to people talk, because I'm on the curb. I take the bus. I listen to people. I'm around people all the time. And they don't believe that there's anything out there to help them. They ask social workers, they ask experts, you know, they call services, and they're kind of told, well, you know, we don't really have anything like that, you know, to help children, especially children with emotional problems or dysfunctions of one kind or another. As far as alcohol and substance abuse, it's rampant, obviously, and I think a lot of it is caused by the despair that people have felt for years in poverty. When you're in poverty and you look at the government and the government is not addressing your concerns, and the first thing they tell you is, well, we don't have the money for these services, you begin to feel that you've been forgotten and you're not important anyway. And it's almost an attitude it's always been that way with the poor. If you're poor and you're downtrodden and you don't make it, it's because you did it yourself. And I think if they went to help if the experts with all these studies and things are doing, if they really want to help people, they need to walk around, they need to take the buses, and they need to talk to people, not have forums and meetings and groups, because it's so unlikely that these kinds of, you know, it's unlikely that I would go to something like that, because they have no interest in going to a study or talking to an expert. They want to know that the people who are trying to help are involved in such a way that they wouldn't mind coming here and being among us.
Debbie, thank you so much for a very eloquent statement there. You've given us a lot to chew upon. I don't want to interrupt you, but I do want to get some response to that. And I'll go around the table. A number of issues were raised there with regard to despair, with regard to meeting people and really finding out what the real people out there are thinking. Jason, are you doing that with your study? Are you talking to real people?
We are talking to real people, and we're talking to, as Bill was saying, people who are in the trenches every day. That's part of the process that we went through for developing this first brief. It wasn't just academics sitting in a room thinking up theoretical statements. It was people who were on the ground doing this work every day, giving us input on what are the issues, what are the set of policies that you think are really going to move things forward. But what the caller says, we were all in here nodding our heads in agreement with her in terms of this isn't about black poverty versus white poverty. The set of recommendations that we're putting forward, even though we're looking at the health and well-being of African Americans, will increase the health and well-being of the entire region. And that's part of the story that we're trying to tell.
But, you know, Bill, you can have all the policies in place that you would want. If the people don't know about them, if they don't know where the resources are, what resources are available to them, what difference does it make?
I felt moved by the remark, because she was basically saying, what's the personal connection? But she created a dichotomy of the personal connection and the policy connection. You need both. And point of fact, the policy connection has to also be formulated in such a way that it does engage and communicate to people that there are services at the ready. It's not sufficient to have money. There has to be infrastructure to let the community know that they have access to opportunities in health care and the like. And so partly we would have failed if we don't delineate that in what we write. I think that it's easy to focus on money, but it's also it's money and what are the other things that you're doing to go along with making sure that people know that they have a caring community and their resources to help them.
Keon, do you want to add to that in any sense? Debbie was quite eloquent, I thought.
Yes, I agree. And not to take away anything from the points that Jason and Bill made, but to in many ways support and add, one of the things that I heard from her is, you know, the lack of kind of engagement. And I think that we are all very interested in community engagement in a very broad sense. And so certainly hoping to think that we can create some structures and opportunities for people who feel that they haven't been heard to be heard. I don't know if this particular project itself is going to be able to answer that particular question or that problem. But what we hope comes out of this as a result of this particular project is that we are able to, you know, provide some opportunities for to listen, to better hear what's going on, because we don't always hear and understand the problems as well. And people who live in particular communities like the one that she, you know, mentioned in South City, they don't always see the opportunities either to be listened to or heard from.
Frustrating. It has got to be terrifically frustrating.
Absolutely.
Before I take another break, I want to bring Danielle into the conversation. Danielle, thank you for waiting. You're on the air. Go ahead.
Hi, thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I was listening to the caller, the lady that had called in that said that she lives in South St. Louis, and I absolutely wholeheartedly agree with her. When I was pregnant with my son, he's 18 now and in college now, but I was a product of community health services. A lot of times at that time, I did not know what was available to me. I had to have somebody to hand deliver you to, because you don't know if you're not in those circles or you don't have that type of help, you don't know what's available to you. And it's very important to see things from their perspective, because what may be automatic or prevalent to somebody, like now I'm a nurse in a community clinic, and there's things that just come second nature to me, but somebody living in that environment that hasn't had those opportunities, things like that don't come second nature to seek out assistance or to seek out programs or to seek out studies or research programs to get their voice out there so that you can understand what the need is and how it may be received by the communities that it can help. So that's very important, actually being in the trenches. I spent 6 years as a correctional nurse before I came here, and that just broadened my view totally. I'm hope to obtain my master's in public health is what I'm working towards. And just being in that environment and being able to speak with people that's their everyday life, and to see their perspective and how their reasoning and their thought process is, because it's totally different. They don't know always what's available to them, and when you make things known, sometimes they seek it out and sometimes they don't. It just depends on, I guess, where they're coming from, but. That is so important.
Danielle, if I may ask you a question, what do you think of studies such as this? I mean, they've happened before. There have been other studies. What is your take on efforts of this kind?
It makes a difference if it's a sincere effort to actually get a result, or if it's just to, I guess, further along maybe another study, if it's going to be of benefit. In understanding that it can't always be a direct, immediate benefit, but if the outcome is derived from a sincere effort to assist people and to make things more accessible and well-known so that they can seek out assistance in the public health realm, then that's a success. If it's more geared towards just to be in the know or just to understand and not necessarily going to be a benefit to the people, then, I mean, it has its benefits as well in other ways, but there's a time for action. And right now we're in such peril as far as public health is concerned. It's really a need for active involvement where you get a tangible outcome.
Danielle, we're so grateful for your call. Thanks for doing that. Before I ask our guests here in studio to respond, I have to take a break. We'll do that. You can think about the comments that Danielle made, if you would, gentlemen, and we'll be back. We are talking with members of the For the Sake of All study team, Dr. Jason Purnell, the head researcher, and Dr. William Tate of Washington University, as is Dr. Purnell. Dr. Keon Gilbert is at St. Louis University. We'll be back to continue this conversation and take more of your calls. 382-8255 is the number. You can send us an email at talk@stlpublicradio.org or tweet at STL on air. Back in just a moment. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Hello again and welcome back. Before we continue our conversation about the study, For the Sake of All, a report on the health and well-being of African Americans in St. Louis, here are some of the stories our St. Louis Public Radio newsroom is following today. Later this afternoon, local education and health care leaders hold a news conference about their opposition to override Missouri House Bill 253. That's the bill which would lower the state income tax for individuals and corporations. The override is expected to be considered during this week's veto session in Jefferson City. Missouri State Auditor releases a report today about a since-scrapped policy in which driver's license clerks were making electronic copies of people's birth certificates and other personal records. And the St. Charles County Council meets tonight and is expected to consider a new smoking ban proposal. Join St. Louis Public Radio this afternoon for local and regional news and throughout the day on our website at stlpublicradio.org. Now back to our conversation with Drs. Jason Purnell, William Tate, and Keon Gilbert. And Bill Tate, I'll go to you first because I know you want to respond to what Danielle was talking about.
She's a living example of what this is about because she articulated in her own personal history. She began her life using community health resources, ultimately appears to have been successful, and became a nurse and contributed in the correctional system, and now is back in the community contributing to public health in the community in a positive way. And partly what we're trying to do with these briefs is to say that people like her and others can take advantage of community health. If they're healthy, they can go to school, they can be productive citizens, they can contribute to our tax base, they can contribute by contributing to our tax base, they contribute to better schools, they contribute to better public health. And the cycle goes from being vicious to being actually very positive. And the extent to which we can advance more and more people just like her, we've been successful.
Either of the other gentlemen have something you'd like to add. Jason?
I want to underscore that policy matters. We're about to have the rollout of the Affordable Care Act here in a few weeks where people can join the exchanges, and that matters. Public health is concerned with population health, so we have to look at the entire population and what kinds of policies and programs are actually going to have a scalable effect on people's lives. You look at the drop in mortality after Medicare and Medicaid were passed. That was substantial. Other public health policies like tobacco taxes have had a substantial impact on what we know is a life-threatening health behavior. So it's important not to downplay the importance of policy in this discussion.
Keon, thoughts?
I think it's very important that, you know, both callers have talked about the issue and understanding of just awareness and even also having access to networks that can provide them or connect them to other resources and assets, as well as just thinking about how that information can be activated. And I think Danielle is a great example of kind of putting her knowledge or new knowledge into action. And certainly I want to congratulate her on graduating a son from high school and getting him to college, because that's certainly a really important thing, especially for the high dropout rates for African-American males and across the country, not only in St. Louis. And so certainly that's a very important thing. But awareness and action, I think, are really two important things that I've heard from both callers.
Jason, do you really feel the Affordable Care Act is going to make a difference?
Oh, I think it's going to make a tremendous difference. We're talking about millions of people who didn't have access to health insurance now have access to health insurance. One of the provisions of the Affordable Care Act, though, is getting people information, and that's been a particular challenge in our state in terms of getting people that information. At the state level, it's been decided that you can't give people information about the Affordable Care Act. So it goes directly to both callers' points about how do you make sure that the policies that are in place, people actually get information about them.
And time's a waste, and October 1st is a big date with regard to all of this. And I haven't heard as much as I would have expected to hear about how to go about signing up for these various exchanges and what have you. That's going to be a problem for a lot of people.
It is.
No question about it. Okay, we had another call we just lost, but I wanted to bring up something going back to what Debbie said. And you alluded to this, Jason, a moment ago. The name of the program, the project that you're involved in, is For the Sake of All, a report on the health and well-being of African Americans in St. Louis. Would you not have been better served if you had left out African Americans and just said for the health and benefit of St. Louisans? I mentioned that because I think we're all realistic enough to know that a lot of people are just going to wave it off. Do you understand what I'm saying? I don't want to offend anybody, but you know what I'm saying. A lot of people are just going to say, well, it's just another project for Black America.
I do understand what you're saying, and that's a very real sort of political calculus. The reason that we're focusing on African Americans is because of the considerable vulnerability of African Americans in this region. We can't turn a blind eye to what are persistent disparities. But what we can do is say that the way to move forward is a way that actually improves the health and well-being of everyone. The kinds of recommendations that we're making, for instance, in early childhood, in terms of helping low and moderate income families to save, that helps all families. And if we're going to be an economically viable and healthy region and globally competitive in the 21st century, we've got to start making provision for everyone, for the sake of everyone. And very often that means shining a bright light on where the disparities are, where are the biggest gaps in terms of access to resources and services.
Bill Tate, any thoughts on that?
Jason provides sort of the social justice perspective on it. I'm just going to be providing economic on cost benefit. When you invest in people's health more broadly, and specifically when you think about St. Louis City being a majority-minority city, when you invest in the majority's health, you save a lot of money. I mean, it's a financial reality, and it also has implications for our tax structure as well in a very positive way for everyone. So I don't think, I respect the question, I think that if we think about it more broadly and from an economic point of view, this is in everyone's economic benefit to actually invest in the health of the community, because you have more productive citizens who contribute to the tax base and make this a much more robust and competitive community.
And Keon, that has to be a big part of the ultimate message from what you're doing.
Absolutely. I think in terms of thinking about how this project may be able to attract or to encourage investment overall, I think is really important, and certainly it will benefit a community that's been highly underserved and considerably vulnerable, as Jason mentioned, as well. I think it's really important for us to kind of just think about the long history that we've had in the United States, not only just in St. Louis or Missouri, but thinking that, you know, some people got a head start. And I think it's really important for us to think about how we can provide resources and tools, as well as other kinds of assets, to many groups that have kind of started the race a little bit behind. I think it's important not only for us to think about communities of color, but how certain policies or initiatives not only can be directed or focused or even targeted towards certain communities, but how even some of the solutions, as Jason mentioned, may be able to be broadened that can help not only that community but other communities.
We've talked a lot on this program about the need for private resources to be brought in and to help. What about the impact of today's economy on the objectives that we're talking about here today? It just seems to me that that's a major obstacle to any improvement in facilities, resources, policies even. Thoughts?
I think we've certainly seen overall, and I don't have the numbers with me in terms of just the decline in health for a number of people as a result of the economic decline, the recession that's occurred, you know, not only just in health but also in terms of assets, you know, thinking about homes being lost, people having to move, or people having to find, you know, when they once had full-time jobs, now having part-time jobs. And so now they can't afford the health insurance that they once had. And so that certainly puts them at risk for developing chronic diseases. And people just even, you know, just the thinking that people are working harder to try to make up for the gap that occurred as a result of the recession is really important to think about. And so I think the economic decline has had both kind of acute and chronic has had both acute and chronic effect on people.
But I think it also goes to, I sort of flip that around and look at it in terms of what happens if you start investing in people that you've written off? What happens if you actually look at people as resources, as potential resources, the children who are in under-resourced neighborhoods and under-resourced schools? that has a ripple effect throughout the economy, throughout the local and regional economy in terms of new businesses created, more jobs, houses bought, cars bought. But we don't typically think of it that way. We think of these neighborhoods or these sections of our region or these children as problems to be solved rather than resources to be invested in.
I would take it one step further and say that the people that we're talking about are invisible to the larger society.
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. I think in terms of even thinking about awareness, being able to in many ways kind of not highlight these groups as problems, but as Jason even mentioned, you know, places to invest, people to invest in because they have been highly invisible. In kind of hip hop culture, a book called author named Trisha Rose kind of talked about the way that hip hop in many ways shines a light on what's going on in many urban communities. And in some ways, this proposal, this project is a way of kind of not only saying, you know, here are some things that maybe aren't going as well, or here's some data that supports some issues that we have known that have been going on, but also here are some opportunities for us to think about how we can come together, how we can collectively problem solve.
We only have a few minutes left. I'd like to put a hypothetical out here and get your input as to how a situation like this, which is a real situation, we've all heard about the food deserts. I think, Jason, you alluded to that before. And there are certain sections of St. Louis in which this is a significant problem. There are no grocery stores. The people don't have access to nutritious food. In the best world scenario, Jason, how do you solve this issue? Let's take a portion of St. Louis and say this is an issue that has to be resolved. How do you solve it?
And there are people who are much more versed in the whole food desert literature than I am. But I think there are creative ways to bring resources to bear in those communities. Alternatives in terms of farmers markets and community gardens, but also real economic investment in some of these neighborhoods.
Who does the investing?
It's going to have to be people with resources. I mean, it's going to have to be
private.
It's got to be private. It's got to be private investment, and that's a reality. This money isn't just going to fall out of the sky, but we've got to make a case for why it makes sense to make those kinds of investments.
Thoughts, Bill Tate?
Very, very hard question. Because when it's left to the private marketplace, they look at risk, reward.
Exactly.
And the dilemma you have is that many of the communities are viewed as a risk. And I mentioned this earlier. Why are they viewed as a risk? Because we have created these communities through policies and practices, some of them private sector, some of them public sector. And now we're living with the fallout of that. It's a shame that it's an experiment to put a reasonable grocery store in a community with human beings who would purchase the food. But that's what it is here in St. Louis. And I don't think that that's right. The economic argument for it is that, you know, if we actually gave these folks the nutrition they need, they could be healthy and productive. We would lower physical illness. It would have an impact on mental illness as well because the acting out and the behavior problems are fundamentally, a lot of the kids just, there's a chemical problem. They don't have any food. So if that were to happen and we took a long-term perspective on it that, you know, these kids would develop and become productive citizens, it would be worth the investment, and I think it'd be worthwhile doing. It's so hard to make an economic argument for it because of what we've created. And that's why the cycle becomes vicious.
It's like that old commercial, pay me now or pay me later. But there is going to be a cost involved.
I mean, here in St. Louis, we have funds that are supposed to be used to develop communities that are under-resourced. And it would take another show to discuss some of the decisions that have been made around those funding sources. But we know what's happened with the TIF here and other things. They haven't been used in ways that have necessarily advantaged indigenous people who might be impoverished. And I think that's a huge deal, and it's impacting us to this very day. Our health and educational outcomes are linked to these decisions. So
Well, we've got just about a minute left. Let me go around the table very quickly and just ask you, Keon, put a bottom line on this conversation in 15 seconds, if you can.
Sure. I think just reflecting on the caller's comments, I think a lot of the initiatives in terms of solving some of the problems really will have to be locally grown. And I think that they will not only have to be locally grown, but both privately and publicly supported.
Bill Tate?
You shouldn't have to be affluent and socially connected to get resources related to your mental health and your and physical illnesses. And if it doesn't stop, we're going to be talking about this as an economic calamity of a grand scale in 10 or 15 years.
Jason?
For the sake of all, is really about investing in everyone and everyone having an opportunity to contribute to a viable region.
Well, you want a conversation to get started. I hope we've gotten a conversation started here today, gentlemen. Thank you so much for being with us. We've been talking with Dr. Jason Purnell of Washington University, Dr. William Tate, also of Washington University, and Dr. Keona Gilbert of St. Louis University. Good luck with your project, gentlemen. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you
for having us.
Thank you.
Tomorrow on St. Louis on the Air, we'll talk about the Missouri Legislature's upcoming veto session and about the National Churchill Museum's new educational outreach efforts and what can be learned from that British leader as the debate over action in Syria continues. Archived versions of past St. Louis on the Air programs are available for download or podcast at stlpublicradio.org. St. Louis on the Air is a production of St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Thank you so much for listening. I'm Don Marsh.